You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
Welcome to Tuesday Home Time with Joan Bartlett. 2 hours of current affairs until 6pm when Done By Law takes over. And thanks to Anne McAllister for the Celtic Folk Show. You might be listening to this program on the old analogue, 8:55 AM, or two other ways, both by way of the internet, 3cr.org.au, either streaming with the program available for a week, or podcast whenever it suits you to listen. Whichever way, don't stop listening to independent media and how important it is. And you can help keep 3CR independent by becoming a subscriber. For the next 2 weeks, we'll be asking our listeners to become financial members. And it is so important to have you on board. And there's lots of ways you can do it. It's $80 waged or $40 unwaged. The phone number to ring during office hours is 9419 8377. Also, during office hours, you can come into the station at 21 Smith Street in Fitzroy. And you can pay at the bank online with Bank Australia. The account name is Community Radio Federation Limited, as I said, with Bank Australia. The BSB is 313140. And the account number is 1206 1489. That's 313 140 1206 1489. Put your name in the reference field and email to admin@3cr.org.au to let us know what you've just done. I do hope you can do that for us to keep independent radio on air, not just for us, but particularly for you. But let's get down to the business of the program today. How hard have you been thinking about what is happening in Syria? Former ESL teacher Susan Durgham has answers you won't hear in the mainstream media. And journalist Nick McClellan will be looking at what Trump's presidency will mean for the Pacific nations. Part two of the monthly review of genetic engineering with Bob Phelps, and I'll be speaking with Yusuf El Rimawi. You might remember Yusuf, who introduced the program now very popular on 3CR, Palestine Remembered, many years ago. Yusuf will be talking about a forum which has been held this Thursday night at the State Library Theatreette, looking at who owns the Holy Land. Perspectives from three people, one a Muslim, one a Christian, and one Jewish. But he's back, Mr. Kevin Healy, so he'll be there first off for you today. So let's get on with the show.
A weak Jane listener, when if we have a world atlas or a world globe lying around, throw them out, redundant, useless. Well, to save money, I suppose we could just write AMERICA across every map or the various latitudes. Make Greater America great again. Loudly flows the Don. And good on the Don for realising that the term Middle East is a colonialist settler conflict, the Middle East of the British Empire, as redundant as the World Atlas. Ignoring the reality of the rules-based order drawn up to make the world a better place by the Great Empire and its Great Empire Pentagon, from now on to be known as the Middle America. Neither east nor west, but either, depending on your starting point. The greatest real estate opportunity ever, ever. limited only by the fact that in the big, big real estate opportunity, non-land, non-people live amidst the rubble and destruction and decay, including the bodies of no longer non-land, non-people. And US of the UN of the US of the world, big supremo Donald Travel the Poor knows it is a Riviera waiting to be liberated. For if there are no people, just non-land, non-people, then these non-land, non-people have no right to get between Donald and a real estate opportunity, standing in the way of progress. This land is my land. This land is my land. From the Atlantic Ocean to the Atlantic shore. But Donald, isn't that the whole world? I see trees of green, red roses too, Trump Towers on Mediterranean blue, and I think to myself, what a wonderful world. Donald, there are also vast resources, vast riches, making it a not-so-wonderful world off the Palestinian non-land, non-people coast. Has that got anything to do with your brilliant plan? Drill, baby, drill. Get in the groove, man. The greatest drill, baby, drill. Greatest wonderful world. Greatest my land ever, ever. And the lucky, lucky residents of my real estate can watch my very close friend and profound thinker, Elon Must Have More, launch spacecraft over the Mediterranean. The greatest space launch ever, ever. But the US of can't be expected to take all the responsibility for this enlightened development. No, no, no. Other countries have a responsibility to take the non-land, non-people off Donald's hands and off Donald's very close friends, Benjamin, not another Yahoo's hands. Benjamin, who can't believe his luck that the voters handed him such a narcissistic pushover. Perhaps the most ingenious thought bubble in Donald's final solution was that the countries with a responsibility to take the non-land, non-people he is throwing out, except they're non-people, so he's not really throwing anyone out, those countries must finance the massive cost of cleaning up the slaughter and destruction Benjamin and the US have inflicted. Ingenious. So Donald and his son-in-law Jared and other socially aware real estate moguls can then create the Riviera. Those who can afford it can enjoy. And if those countries Donald orders to take the non-land, non-people show a bit of reluctance, like, but the non-land is the non-people's land, well, they're non-land, then wham, tariffs, punishment, US of style. Not sure Donald's thought that one through quite as much, that if you keep hitting people with financial penalties, they may, wait for it, decide to hit you with financial penalties. Lose, lose. And clearing the rubble and the non-land, non-people won't pose any risk for those countries because they'll be working under the protection of US of and Zion-trained killers. The latter keeping up their killing skills during the so-called ceasefire, the hiatus, over on the West Bank, more non-land, non-people, and as hostages and prisoners are swapped on one side, prisoners mostly never facing any charges but locked up for the heinous crime of looking askance at a Zion train killer terrorist, opposing train killers keeping them in order, while over in the West Bank, the Zion train killer terrorists are arresting hundreds more who look a bit askance at daily slaughter and destruction. That is not breaching the terms of the agreement, because under the terms of the agreement, only the non-land, non-people can breach the agreement. Incomprehensibly, the odd world leader in international organisation are a touch critical of the Don's inspired solution. Hurtful comments like genocide, ethnic cleansing, war criminal, but thankfully, our very own courageous leader, Anthony Albanese, didn't join the chorus, singing as usual from the Great American Songbook, asserting he does not comment on what other people say, brackets, when it suits him not to, close brackets, and telling us we support a two-state solution. Oh, that's good, Anthony, although if the non-land, non-people are forced out of Gaza by Donald and Benjamin, and out of the West Bank, or what's left of the West Bank that Zionist settlers haven't stolen, exactly where will the two-state be? That must be determined by negotiation between the parties. Between the non-land, non-people and Zion. Between Benjamin and Donald. But Benjamin has said there will never be a non-land, non-people state. These things aren't easy. Moving on, Anthony, you've always opposed on principle mandatorily locking people up for so-called hate speech, like opposing slaughter and destruction and genocide, and for symbols of hate and terror, like non-land, non-people flags and kafirs. Why have you changed your principled position, Anthony? I was left with no choice. No choice? Constable Duffer said I was weak, not supporting it. And then? Then he called me weak for supporting it. Poor Anthony. See, he's correct. These things aren't easy. Speaking of lock-up, Matilda's captain Sam Kerr faces jail for calling a copper white and stupid. Hang on. The copper is white. What's criminal there? And stupid? He's a copper, therefore a given. Since when is the truth a lock-up offence? Well, of course it is. I recommend we don't carry or wear any Palestinian symbols to rallies, or we'll be done for symbols of hate and terror, and only say nice things about the slaughter and destruction and genocide. Nice things about Zion and Zion-trained killers, or we'll be done for hate speech. For the people for whom these laws are made, who complain about hate speech, would never dream of using hate speech themselves. Unless we consider calling for the destruction of an entire race hate speech, on which the aforementioned caring business class party supremo and would-be big supremo, Constable Peter Duffer, praised Donald's final solution, which he declared, obviously after deep research, would not break international law. Donald, a big thinker and dealmaker. Like, you know, a big thinker. And, well, it's Donald and Pete, so, yeah, big thinker, it's relative. Must look up a bit of international law that says it's lawful to march into someone's country, send in the Marines, as Tom Lehrer satirised, as the solution to every problem, the trained killers, expel the population, and hand it to the real estate industry. When we think about it, we do that already on a local basis, get rid of the flora and fauna and hand it over to the real estate industry. Industry. We've mentioned several times over the journey poor BHP, for bloody huge profits, bloody huge polluter, faced with this disastrous same job, same pay legislation, pointing out that if it paid its in-house labour hire workers doing the same job, it would cost it $3 billion, and we still can't find any other reason that it's ripping off those workers to the tune of, yes, $3 billion, until now. The matter has hit the Fair Work True Blue Aussie No Longer Work Choices Just Looks Like It con mission, where Bloody Huge explained the evil union has got it all wrong. It's not same job, same pay, but same looking job. And the evil, evil unions want same pay for the same looking job. See, the lower paid in-house labour hire workers are contracted, important word, contracted, for different purposes, and it just looks like they're doing the same work. We know the law's pretty stupid, but if it buys that one, it's more stupid than we thought. Meanwhile, this week, caring employers got together with big economic guru Jim Chalmers Capital and his shadow Angus Tailings, and caring business class relations minister Murray Swatch Unions, to point out the world has shifted and many crippling work practices must shift with it. Expressed beautifully by Herbert Smith Free Kills Workers Supremo Rebecca Maslin Stoneage. That's the Free Kills Workers, which drew up work choices for Little Johnny and Peter Root, the workers. Rebecca telling the government we must commit to cutting red tape, pursuing tax reform, that is the rich paying lots less than the lots they don't pay anyway, and most importantly, boost workplace flexibility. Flexibility and productivity. Poor caring employers toss and turn all night, knowing inflexibility and low productivity are killing this country. And penalty rates and the right to disconnect are examples of barriers to flexibility, Rebecca bemoaned. Silly us. Just when we thought they may have been examples of flexibility. Inflexible Mother Earth spent the break with extremes all over the world just to celebrate Donald's contribution to climate change, if there is such a thing, with Drill Baby Drill. And finally, as the caring business class met with the government again this week, figures showed millions and millions of the socialist and caring business class party's incomes came from very expensive business offshoots providing access to government, some civil liberties people pointing out that this was access denied most of us. Bloody spoil sports. No connection, of course, but as Anthony kickstarted his election campaign in Western Trublawasi, he handed $1 billion of our hard-earned to our filthiest rich of the filthy rich, Gina, and it was revealed he met with several key sporting, gambling and media bigwigs just before caving in, deciding he needed more time to think about how not to ban gambling ads and promotion. Anyway, the caring business class party informing us that as the election approaches and the socialists cave in, why does that word keep cropping up? Who said Anthony Albing is weak? Adopt everything the caring business class lot ordered them to adopt. The price of access to Constable Duffer to sit next to him at fundraising dinners has doubled. Good grief, listener, I'm sure we'd pay double not to be in the same room. Good afternoon.
And that was Mr. Kevin Healy with his week that was, and it's great to have him back on the program once more. And you can hear Kevin again tomorrow morning on Sydney Limits between 9 and 10.
Being a 3CR subscriber is vitally important to keeping us community-controlled, grassroots and on-air 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year.
Every 3CR show is a progressive voice that enriches and informs our communities.
From gardening and music to current affairs and First Nations voices, we broadcast expert community knowledge, offering perspectives beyond the mainstream media.
Subscribe today to be part of community-owned and community-controlled media.
Show your solidarity. Subscribe.
Go to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377.
Who owns the Holy Land? Is the title of a forum which takes place on Thursday the 13th of February between 6:30 and 8 p.m. at the State Library Victoria Village Roadshow Theatre. With the questions, are Jews and Muslims historic enemies? What is the role of religion in the ongoing violence between Israelis and Palestinians? And what is the role of Palestinian Christians? The three panellists are Yusuf Al-Rimawi, Palestinian musician and scholar, founder of the Averis Centre of Arab Culture and the Palestine Remembered programme on 3CR. Nachshon Amir is a former Israeli army combat officer who was raised in a religious nationalist family but has been an active member of the Free Palestine Melbourne for the past 4 years. Susan Wahab is president of Palestinian Christians in Australia, who was raised in Ramallah following the expulsion of her family from Jaffa and Ramleh in 1948. The moderator is Michael Sheikh, PIN project officer and founding member of Free Palestine Melbourne. And it's hosted by PIEN, which is the Palestine-Israel Ecumenical Network, and Free Palestine Melbourne. I spoke with Yusuf yesterday. How are you going to address those three questions that come up in this panel? Who owns the Holy Land? Are Jews and Muslims historic enemies? And what role does religion play in the ongoing problems today? How are you going to answer those three questions?
Well, with difficulty, to say the least, because we don't necessarily look at the conflict from a purely religious point of view. Some of Palestinians and some of Israelis think religion is the prime the most important element of the conflict. But whether or not this is right or wrong, this is not the place to say maybe we should have a different approach, because what matters is the storytelling behind it. So I would say that if the Palestinian cause or if the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is a sea, religion is one major river that is streaming into it. And this is stemming from the fact that the Zionist movement have deployed religion to implement their project of establishing in Palestine a state of Jewish majority. And for that to happen, you cannot convince the Jews in East Europe and in Europe and all around the world to migrate to a place that has no religious importance, or it would be with more difficulty. That's why in the Zionist conference in 1897, there was a list of countries as a proposed destination for that Jewish state, in addition to Palestine, including in Latin America and in Africa, and some even would say parts of Australia. And they found it's going to be very difficult to convince the Jews to migrate to, let's say, Argentina. With Palestine, there is a historical and religious connection. So religion has been used by the Zionists, and we were pushed to focus on our Islamic or Christian part of the story in response to that. So I don't want to give prolonged answers, but I do think that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict is a conflict of human rights. Whether or not you deny a group of people the rights to live in a human condition. Today in 2025, we cannot accept anymore that there are on stolen land, there are segregated based on ethnicity or religion, segregated roads, segregated schools, segregated workplaces. So it's a matter to me, I would see the Palestinian-Israeli conflict from a humanitarian point of view, a human rights issue. But religion do play a big role.
We'll talk about the historic scene in Palestine. I suppose it'd be like a number of countries around the world where there are different ethnic groups and they've always lived together. They mightn't always be in harmony, but they've always lived together, and they haven't ended up as it has been now with the ethnic cleansing and slaughter of Palestinians.
Historically, if you look at Palestine and Iraq and Egypt and Middle East and North Africa, you will see that in the last 4 or 5 or even millennia, there has been great examples of coexistence between Muslims and Christians and Jews and other religious groups. The Arab world is a very vast region of 14 million square kilometers. In addition to the mainstream ethnic group, which is the Arabs, there are 35 other minorities, religious minorities, ethnic minorities. Some of these minorities have different religions, and they have coexisted in relatively peaceful way. And we know that, for example, after the Spanish Inquisition, where the Catholics persecuted the non-Catholics, including other Christians, but more importantly, Jews and Muslims in the Iberian Peninsula. Who gave the Jews protection? It was the Muslim countries in Morocco and in Algeria and in Tunisia, and later the Ottoman Empire. And there is also examples of coexistence in contemporary history, the 19th century, where you go to Cairo and you see that in New Egypt during the Muhammad Ali Pasha and his descendants, the state relied on non-Muslims to advance their industries, and the Jews were giving a very important role to play in the trade and in the early stages of cinema production and the music production. If we see the black and white movies in Arabic language, we will see that behind this there are producers and actors and actresses of Jewish faith. And we didn't know. Some of them kept their Jewish name. Others chose artistic names that are more neutral, like Leila Murad. So it wasn't a problem whatsoever. And I can also give the example of Iraq. Iraq, from a purely musical point of view, in the early in the first half of this of the 20th century, if you are a musician in Iraq, if you are a singer, if you play an instrument, 95% that you are a Jewish Iraqi. I don't want to say all Iraqi musicians in the first half of the century were of Jewish faith, but I would say at least 95% of them were Jewish Iraqis. They advanced the Iraqi music, they advanced Arabic music, they advanced the Iraqi scale, they gave their hearts and souls and minds to the Iraqi art, to the Arab art, and nobody knew, nobody, even those who knew that they were of Jewish faith, it didn't matter, because what mattered more was the music and singing. So what I want to say that we had every reason to believe that if it wasn't for Zionism, the Arab world would have continued on the path of coexistence between Muslims and Christians and Jews. And I want to give two examples of non-Arab groups, of minority groups that came to the Middle East and North Africa in the 19th century and the 20th century, in addition to the Jews. So let's put the Jewish migration aside. Let's talk about two examples. The Circassians, or what we call them in Arabic, Sherkas. The Circassians came from Central Asia after the Russian-Circassian wars of the 19th century, where they were driven out from Dagestan, from Turkmenistan, from Chechnya, Ingushetia, from other Central Asian countries to the Ottoman Empire. And some of them went to the Arab world. There are in Jordan, one of the most beautiful colors of the Jordanian mosaic of ethnicities is the Sherkas or the Circassians. And if you Google the bodyguards of the current king, King Hussein and his son, King Abdullah of Jordan, you will see them dressed in the Central Asian uniform because they were accepted and they brought their cuisine, they brought their dress code, they brought their language, they brought their even dancing and culture to Jordan, and they became Jordanian. And the local Jordanians didn't see them of less Jordanian than any other group of Jordan. And if you say, okay, these people are Muslims and they assemble in Jordan easily, I will give an example of the Armenians. The Armenians who came to the Middle East, whether in Palestine, in Jordan, in Iraq and Syria and Egypt, they came after the 1915 genocide. When they arrived, they were given protection. They were allowed to own land. They were allowed to keep their religion. And there is in Jerusalem a neighborhood that is called the Armenian Quarter. And they are not less of Jerusalemites than the Arab Jerusalemites, whether or not they are Muslims or not. So the bottom line has the Jewish migration followed the Armenian model. Palestine would have been more beautiful. They would have brought to Palestine their arts and their advancement in law and in medicine, and we would have been one of the vibrant hubs of the region. But instead, Zionism poisoned the atmosphere and made this kind of evil ideology where they convinced some of the Jews that they are more superior, and they brought the primacy. And our problem is not with the members of the Jewish faith. It's with the supremacy, whether this supremacy is Jewish or white or colonial or even Iranian or Arab or Turk or any form of supremacy is rejected.
And how do those who have followed the Christian faith, how have they fared under Zionism?
Now, to understand the Christian-Palestinian issue, we have to put it in context before the inception of or the creation of Israel. The Christians of Palestine have been one of the early migrants, Christians of Levantine in general, Syria and Lebanon and Palestine included, were the early pioneers of migration to North America, to South America, and even to Australia. And that's why we have in Australia the earliest Arabic speaking migrants were from Lebanon and mostly Christian. And that was because towards the end of the Ottoman era, there has been an understanding or a perception among them of intolerance of the state towards them. And they migrated for opportunities and for economy. But they were not the only groups. It was not, there was no anti-Christian sentiment in the Ottoman Empire. But there was more of lack of tolerance towards any other groups, including the Arabs at the end of the Ottoman era after 1908 onwards. So in addition to that, there was also the general spirit among the Christians is that we are the landowners and we were the first Palestinians and the first Syrians and the first Lebanese before some of the Palestinians and Lebanese and the Levantines converted to Islam. And they were the most authentic and the most indigenous groups of this land. And the Muslims didn't even debate this. They lived in harmony with the local Muslims, and they still do in Palestine. But then came Israel, and Israel targeted them in a series of policies to drive them to increase the percentage of migration more. And if you look at the figures today, you will see that after Israel, there are less Christians than ever. And even if you look at the same figures in Iraq, for example, there was nearly 1 million Christian Iraqis before the U.S.-led invasion of Iraq in 2003. And look at now how many, what's the percentage? I think it's no more than 150,000. So there is this kind of European colonialism or European-supported colonialism like Israel that targets minorities. And even under the name of protecting minorities, they sabotage the harmony that was built and created and sustained for centuries. And the result is that the minorities are the most vulnerable and they are the first to leave. Unfortunately, the migration of the Christian Palestinians is very high, but this doesn't take away the Christianhood of Palestine. In the Palestinian national movement, especially in 50s and 60s and 70s, the Christian Palestinians they spearheaded the movement. For example, the second biggest political party in PLO, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, was founded by George Habash, who is a Christian. The third biggest political party in PLO, which is the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine, DFLP, was founded and led by a Christian Jordanian, Naif Hawatmi. Now, while George Habash and Hawatmi did not see themselves as devout religious Christians, but they are Christians. So there is no question whatsoever of the Christianhood of Palestine. And that's why we have leaders like Yasser Arafat, when he refers to Jerusalem, he would start with the Christian parts of Jerusalem before he mentions the mosque. So in his speeches, he would say Jerusalem and its churches and its mosques. Bethlehem, so he would highlight the Christianity of Palestine as equal or even more important to give a message that the Christian Palestinians, even though that they are not proportionate in numbers, but we are equally Palestinians. And the question of religion is not an issue of division. Now, one might say that some of the political Islamic groups might not agree with that, but This is another area of discussion. And even within Hamas, even within political Islam in its Palestinian form, they have evolved and they have now accepted in their second charter in 2017, they have accepted that Christian Palestinians is as Muslim Palestinians before their proposed or vision of the liberation. So in general, the Christian Palestinians were more hit hard by the Zionists project because of their smaller number.
In closing, Yusuf, could we say that the focus on warring religious groups in the Holy Land is a smokescreen for what is really happening?
In a way it is, but it is also, we have to accept our responsibility as Palestinians or supporters of Palestine to do what we can to reduce the polarization on religion, because while there has been an intervention of course, Israel and the United States and colonial powers to upset the religious and sectarian equilibrium of the region in favor of division, the ingredients of this is authentic, and we have to pay attention to our responsibility as Muslims and as Christians of the Middle East, of Palestine in general, and also as supporters of the Jewish faith or members of the Jewish faith, not to fall into the division and not to, even if there are in the last 20 years examples of intolerance and sectarian violence in, let's say, Iraq and in Syria and in parts of North Africa like Egypt. So we have to accept our responsibility not to fall in the division. So it is a smoke screen, but also we have some homework to do.
Okay, well, that'll be your final words.
I would say, yes, I accept our responsibility in highlighting the peace and harmony and tolerance. And also, we have to take every measure, especially those who give views on public spheres, to swim against the stream if the stream is divisive. And I'm sending this message to my fellow Palestinians and fellow supporters of the Palestinian cause, who sometimes, under the pretext of, you know, defending their religious affiliation, they might fall into what can be viewed as intolerance. So I say to them, let's all remember how we lived for centuries, and let's all focus on the Palestinianhood of Palestine. And that's why we say Palestine is Arab. And by saying Arab, it's not a nationalistic and divisive call. It is Arab because it is home for all Arabic speaking and all those, and even those who don't speak Arabic as a first language, but they live in an Arabic speaking majority places. So it's home for Muslims, for Christians, for Druze, for any one of the 35 other minorities that live in the Arab world.
Thank you so much, Yusuf.
Thank you, Jan.
I've been speaking with Yusuf Al-Rimawi, one of the three panellists on the forum this Thursday, the 13th of February. Who owns the Holy Land? It's from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the State Library Victoria, the Village Roadshow Theatreette, and the entrance door is from Latrobe Street in Melbourne. Tickets are $20 and $10 concession, and you can purchase your tickets from Humanifix, HumanIfix. That's Thursday, this Thursday coming, 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the State Library of Victoria.
You ready to make a difference? My name is Nasser Mashni. I host Palestine Remembered each Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. It's Australia's only dedicated radio show on Palestine. 3CR Community Radio is more than just a station. It's a platform for voices you won't hear anywhere else. And we need you. 3CR is an outlet that gives a voice to the voiceless. For nearly five decades, 3CR has amplified the struggles, stories, and successes of marginalised and silenced communities. From First Nation voices to workers' rights and grassroots campaigns to global solidarity, this is where justice speaks. When you subscribe to 3CR, you're not just tuning in, you're taking a stand. You're supporting independent media that fights for truth, diversity, and equality. 3CR is powered by people like you. No ads, no corporate control, just raw, real radio created by the community for the community. So what are you waiting for? Show your solidarity today. Subscribe to 3CR and help us keep the airways free for voices that matter.
What's taking place in Palestine is horrendous.
Here are some ways that you can keep yourself informed and involved.
Listen in to Palestine Remembered every Saturday morning at 9:30 a.m. or listen to the podcast. Join the APAN mailing list at apan.org.au for updates, news about actions you can get involved in, and where you can donate to provide humanitarian assistance.
Listen to other news and current affairs programs on 3CR that also cover Palestine.
The oppression of the Palestinian people has been going on for 75 years. It has to stop. You can be part of making that happen by staying informed and active.
APAN is a proud supporter of 3CR.
Today, a focus on Syria, where the government of President Bashar al-Assad fell on the 8th of December. 2 months later, what is the reality of life in Syria? Indeed, what was the reality of life in Syria prior to the now control of the country by HTS, the Islamic militant group led by Ahmed Hussein al-Shaar, formerly known as Mohammed Abu Jalani, a group prescribed by Australia as a terrorist group, and their allies who have been parading, flying ISIS and Al-Qaeda flags. And why is Australia, together with other Western nations, supporting a wanted terrorist and a founding member of ISIS, as well as a founding member of Al-Qaeda in Syria? And who are the countries who facilitated his move to the top in Syria? These are the questions Susan Durkham asks. Susan is a retired ESL teacher. She taught at the British Council in Damascus from September 2003 to January 2006. She is the editor of the magazine Beloved Syria, Considering Syrian Perspectives. She is a national coordinator for Australians for Reconciliation in Syria. In 2023, she founded Australians for Reconciliation and Truth Towards Syria, whose main aim was to lobby the government to lift the sanctions on Syria and establish ties between Australians and Syria, particularly in the arts. When I spoke to Susan last week, I asked her how she was feeling now, 2 months after the fall of the Syrian government.
Great grief for secular Syria, and terribly, terribly worried for the people of Syria, because there's ongoing violence there that we're not told about. It's not reported here. But I think it's very hard for people who haven't been following it closely to have an understanding of what's happened. If there was one person I would point them in the direction of, it might be Jeffrey Sachs from Columbia University. And I think he presents a pretty foundational understanding of Syria, the war in Syria. He spoke at length in October last year to a group of Cambridge University students. It was October, so you can still see it online. It's about more than an hour long. But what's interesting is that President Trump took a clip from that video, from that talk, and he posted it on social media. The short clip he took and posted was Jeffrey Sachs saying that wars in Iraq, war in Syria were phony wars, and they were wars, games. Basically, he used the word games, games of narrative. He blamed Netanyahu to a large extent for these wars. He said Netanyahu basically had talked the US into going to war against Iraq. Netanyahu apparently, Jeffrey Sachs talks about this in different interviews, apparently he wrote a book in 1995, somewhere around then, called Fight Against Terror, or The Fight Against Terrorism. And his theory was, okay, if we want to get rid of Hamas and Hezbollah, we have to get rid of the countries that support them. And the countries that supported them at that point were Iraq, Syria, and Iran. So he had these countries on his list to target, to topple, the governments to topple. That's basically the reason for the war against Syria. And Jeffrey Sachs talks about the CIA being committed to regime change in Syria, and Obama tasked them to do that. So I think that's really important to have that foundational understanding, to realise that it was not just a proxy war. Of course, it was a proxy war, but it was a phony war. And so you have to investigate the narratives, and you have to investigate the players, and don't take anything at face value. Do your own research. But that's a really good place to start from.
Can you build on that?
Yeah. Well, I wrote to the Prime Minister. Do you mind if I read? That was actually published in Pearls and Irritations. And so if it's lost in my reading, you can find it on Pearls and Irritations. It starts with the concern about the ABC, really. So I write about the dangers inherent in the pervasive gullibility and ignorance that exist in Australia in relation to the war in Syria. And I mentioned that well-respected ABC Radio National programs, and I love Radio National, I used to, such as God Forbid and Late Night Live, have become, if only by inference, cheerleaders for the agendas of Hayrat Tahrir al-Sham, so HTS, which has its origins in Al-Qaeda and ISIS, and which is still designated a terrorist organisation by the Australian government. So why I wrote that is because the presenters of God Forbid and Late Night Live, so in this case James Carlton and David Marr, interviewed two women about the coup, if you like, the coup in Damascus on the 8th of December, and they were both celebrating that coup by a designated terrorist organisation. And the presenters, David Marr and James Carlton, were sort of gushing and celebrating with them and congratulating them, which was just extraordinary, and not asking questions, not asking. It's as if they knew nothing, and these women were there to tell them the truth, and they just trusted them completely. So it's pretty scary that we are so ignorant and so gullible and so not probing, not asking questions. Going back to my letter, I said there was a Syrian Christian commentator who's worth following. He's very analytical, very objective, I think. He's based in Germany. I think he left Aleppo. He lived in Aleppo, and I think he left maybe in 2015, 2016, and he was a refugee in Germany. His name's Kevork, so K-E-V-O-R-K, Almasian, A-L-M-A-S-S-I-A-N. And he pointed out, and I think this is very important for Australia too, that endorsing Gilani's regime, so HTS in Syria, sends a very dangerous and clear message to the youth of the Middle East that to gain political relevance, you join radical militant groups. And I say to the Prime Minister in my letter that young Muslim Australians are also receiving this message that joining radical militant Islamist groups is okay. And for that reason, our politicians and community leaders would have difficulty dissuading them when even the ABC seems to be suggesting that the theology or the ideology of Al-Qaeda is almost mainstream.
Take you back to what you were saying about the programs on Radio National with James Carlton and David Marr. If you had been in the studio asking questions, what would you have asked those two women who they were interviewing?
I would have wanted to know about the ideology of the groups that had taken over. I would have wanted to know the composition in terms of foreign jihadists. I would have wanted to know whether women, Syrian women, would be welcoming them. Were Syrian women going to lose their freedom, for example, their freedom to dress as they like, their freedom to travel around the city, the country by themselves? And these are freedoms that are being lost, by the way, but so they're very relevant. I would have wanted to ask about the sectarianism that's fundamental to their ideology of these groups. I would have wanted to know who the clerics who inspire these groups are, and what do these clerics say. I would have wanted to know how they've been funded, who funds them, who the puppet masters are. I mean, perhaps that doesn't sound very objective, but who funds them, basically? And in this case, it would be Turkey, Qatar, mainly, I think. And how much is the Muslim Brotherhood involved? And is the Muslim Brotherhood represented by Turkey, Qatar? And how much does the Muslim Brotherhood ideology seep into the reporting of Al Jazeera, for example? There are a lot of questions. I think the producers of these programs should be doing more research and, yeah, just asking questions. Because my thought was these presenters, they're gushing and approving of whatever's said to them by these people who support the new regime, would they gush and approve? For example, if they interviewed Kevork Elmasian, I mean, you have to have an objective stance because there are so many different perspectives there. You have to be prepared for the different perspectives and not favour one, which is what they were doing.
Can I ask you to go through some of those issues that you just spoke about? And first, women's freedom and the lack of control of many people in society in Syria under the former regime. You've experienced it. You've got friends there. How would you have answered that question?
Before December the 8th, women, I think their freedom was comparable to our freedom here. So women were able to move around as they wanted to study, to work. There are lots of professional women in my classes at the British Council, lots of women showing their cleavage, in the summer. And it didn't matter what background they were from. Women from Sunni Muslim backgrounds, Christian backgrounds, Shia backgrounds, they dressed as they wanted. So some dressed very conservatively, some dressed as if they were in Paris or Milan. Women were very smartly dressed in Syria. Women were very assertive and very strong. And I think they were gaining, they were definitely gaining freedoms. I interviewed a woman in 2010 who had been on a Fulbright scholarship in America. She was, you know, very articulate in English, highly intelligent. And she was saying that basically the women, her generation of women, but she was in her 20s, felt as though they had won most of the freedoms of Western women, but they still needed the sexual freedom that we have. That was still a fight in front of them. Well, that's finished now because, I mean, that fight is, and other fights just to dress freely now as they want, is way ahead of them. It'll take maybe decades to get that back. Well, I don't know. But the current, for example, the current justice minister, the new justice minister, is known to have overseen public executions of women in Syria, in Idlib, who were accused of adultery, which might just be another word for prostitution. So you've got women in Syria these days who are suffering terribly because of everybody's suffering, but you've got many women who are in charge of families, perhaps because their husbands have died, their sons have died, been killed. And so you've got many families that are female-led families, suffering great poverty, basically because of the sanctions. That's another question I would have asked. There have been people celebrating, definitely, a lot of people celebrating in Syria, the new regime. But why have they been celebrating? Have they been celebrating because they're thinking, well, now we will be saved by the West and they will lift the sanctions and the economic situation will improve? We'll have electricity more than 4 hours a day. So, yeah, in going back to the situation for women, one of the first things that the new regime did was dismiss women judges. They had quite a few women judges in Syria and they were all dismissed. So professional women are being dismissed. And also some tragic news that has come out in the last couple of weeks is the abduction and killing, torture and killing of a professor of Arabic at the University of Homs, Dr. Rasha Al-Ali, and her body was found and her fingers had been cut off. And what I noticed today on social media is the kidnapping of young Syrian women, and some of them have been released days after their kidnapping, and others have not yet been released. So, yeah, the situation in Syria is awful, really, really awful, for many reasons, many, many reasons.
Now, there are a number of minority religious groups in Syria. How did they exist under the former government, and what are your fears and what's been shown in this 2 months of the new government, how they're going to survive?
Well, in Syria, you have a significant Christian population, a significant Shia and Alawi population, and Druze and Kurds. And within those groups, so within the Christian population, you've got different sects. So you've got, you know, the Orthodox, the Protestant, the Catholic, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very mixed society, very pluralist society. And when I was living in Syria, to talk about your religion was really taboo. And so I think there was a understanding that you didn't want to stir up sectarian hatred, and it was respected. And so you didn't ask someone, you just didn't ask someone what your religion is, because your religion, I think it was encouraged and people accepted this. I mean, the people I knew, which were mainly educated Syrians, accepted that your religion was between you and God. But of course, you live within your religious community as well. And those communities, you know, varied. There wasn't one Sunni community or one Christian community. So, you know, you could have within the Sunni community, of course, people. And I would say a majority of Sunni Muslims who respected the secular state. So they were devout. People in Syria, whatever religion they came from, were usually devout. Christians, devout Muslims, but they respected the secular state, which meant that they could live in harmony. And I think what's been written about Syria is that it was an Alawi regime, which is not true. The government of Syria was made up of basically the people of Syria, as it's, you know, if you looked at the percentage of Sunnis or Sunni Muslims in Syria, it was something like over 70%, maybe 75%. So you'd find that reflected in the army, you'd find it reflected in the government, and the same with Christians and Alawis. But the president, of course, was Alawi, but his wife was Sunni. The prime minister, ones that I know of, were Sunni. His intelligence advisor was Sunni. And so I think they had worked out how to live in that mosaic, that Syrian mosaic, with a sense of harmony. And in fact, can I quote the Prime Minister? Because I think Prime Minister Albanese, understood this. I'm going to find this quote if I can. In 2013, at a community function attended by many Syrian Australians, Anthony Albanese described Syria as a sophisticated secular state where people could live side by side with respect. And that's the Syria I knew. It was just a beautiful country. But, of course, you have to place it in the region. And so it had been basically at war with Israel since 67, or even before that, if you like. And so there was lots of stuff going on in Syria. I mean, the security services did a lot of nasty things, but they had a lot of problems as well to deal with. So there was a lot of, I think, agents, Zionist agents working in Syria, people that's linked to the CIA as well. One of my colleagues, for sure, was a CIA agent. So it's complicated. It's so complicated. And Syria, going back to what Jeffrey Sachs said, it was a phony war. Syria was targeted and the government was toppled through very dirty means.
Tell me what you know about the history of Jalani.
I think the best way, the simple way to answer that is to quote what Tulsi Gabbard said to the US Senate committee hearing last week. I don't know how many of your listeners would have given attention to that, but I don't think the ABC gave any attention to it. So Tulsi Gabbard is a former US congresswoman, and she's also a veteran, so she served some time in Iraq, and she's been nominated by President Trump to be his director of intelligence. And she was questioned in the US committee hearing, and one thing she said was that, which is very, very important, that the US government was on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria. And she mentions Jalani, the leader of HTS, and she said that on 9/11 he danced in the street, and he also killed American soldiers in Iraq. So in Iraq he was in ISIS, the Islamic State of Iraq, and then he was sent to Syria to set up al-Nusra, which is the group affiliated with al-Qaeda. And so people say he's killed people, he's decapitated people. So yeah, I would say he's a nasty man, but he's been welcomed by various Western governments. Can I just go on and also talk about what Tulsi Gabbard said in relation to Syria? Because it's really significant that she was able to say this in Washington. So she mentioned that the American government had supported or had been on the side of Al-Qaeda in Syria. She gave evidence of that. And then she said that, well, I'm not sure if she said it directly, but it's understood from her position and from her responses to questions that the US intelligence community didn't give support to the White House for their claims that the Assad government had used chemical weapons. Now, this is really significant. So the White House claimed that, for example, Assad had used chemical weapons against his people in 2013, 2018, in some major alleged chemical weapons attacks. And the point she was making was that actually the intelligence community didn't support those claims. Those claims were made by political people in the White House. And she also referred in the Senate committee hearing, she referred to the whistleblowers at the Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons, the OPCW. And these whistleblowers who went into Syria to investigate the use of chemical weapons in 2018, their report from their investigation, on-the-ground investigation, suggested that the Assad government wasn't responsible for a chemical attack, that it was staged. But the headquarters of the OPCW manipulated the reports or didn't reveal what was said by these people on the ground, the OPCW people on the ground. And so they presented a different report. And so Tulsi Gabbard, what she said was that those whistleblowers should not have been ignored. And if she, for example, does get that position of director of intelligence, she would not ignore such whistleblowers, which is so significant.
There is the suggestion that he's just a puppet of the West. We pretty amazed when we saw him change from his Islamic dress to a suit and tie very, very soon after that. If he doesn't perform, if he doesn't bring up the goods, what is the role that he has to play? If he doesn't do it, he might get kicked out. But what do they want him to do in Syria?
What they want him to do, he's probably done already.
But how to run the country? Or who's going to run the country?
Yeah, good question. I think, well, it's hard to know, Jan, but the fear is that they're going to break up Syria, that there's been an awful lot of violence against the minorities, so against Alawis in particular, Shia and Christians as well. And so people in certain areas that are, you know, being massacred are going to take a stand. So there's going to be some resistance. So there's going to be ongoing fighting. And so it might be decided by the great powers, by, you know, Turkey, the people that have, you know, the usual suspects, those people that have been involved, Israel. For example, Israel now controls 40% of the water, Syrian water. So these powers that have got a hand now in controlling areas of Syria, America still occupying the oil-rich area, these powers might just say, well, we'll divide it up. So there'll be a Sunni Syria, an Alawite Syria, a Kurdish Syria, a Druze Syria. So it'll be balkanized, which is, I think, the plan that goes back some years now, which is very worrying, of course. And Turkey, some commentators have said Turkey will try and take the coastal part of Syria because there's apparently gas resources there. So it all has to do with resources in the end. The US has the oil. Turkey wants the gas in the Mediterranean along the coast. Israel has the water resources, 40% of the water resources. Yeah, Turkey's got some water resources as well. Yeah, it's a dirty, dirty game.
And no thoughts for the people involved, the people of Syria who are going to suffer?
No, who've been suffering for what, how many years? Is it now 14 years? And unfortunately, many of those people have been blinded. And that was the point of it too, that the Syria I knew, the Syria that Prime Minister Albanese understood to exist as well, that secular Syria that, you know, was peaceful and stable and there was harmony and people loved it. There was a real attachment to the country and people understood that, and it linked, that love for country connected people. The communities were very strong. That's been smashed, deliberately smashed. So now you get a lot of sectarian thought amongst people in Syria. They've started to believe the narrative, you know, that we are better than they. So there's hatred in Syria between people and, you know, pointing fingers, blaming the other, that didn't exist before. And that's something that can impact Australia as well. You know, it's going to impact communities here.
So your final words?
I think we should be paying attention to Syria because it's not just the people of Syria that are suffering. We also are impacted, and I think we have been involved in that dirty game against Syria, in the war, in the phony war against Syria. I think it's compromised our values, it's undermined ABC standards, it's radicalizing people in our community, and I don't know, we're not paying attention to the loss of freedom that women are facing in Syria, and yet we pay attention to perhaps the loss of freedom people have in Iran. So we're sort of being prepped for another war, a war in Iran, using women to motivate us to sort of support a war against Iran, but we don't pay attention to the situation of women in Syria. So we're being manipulated. My final word is stand up, pay attention. If you want to listen to one person, listen to Professor Sachs.
Good
as a starting point.
Thank you, Susan.
Thank you, Alan.
And Susan Durgham is a retired ESL teacher and active in promoting ties between the people of Syria and Australia, particularly in the arts and much more.
Beautiful listeners, this is Priya from the Thursday Morning Breakfast Show on 3CR 855 AM, and I am making this message to ask you to show your solidarity by subscribing to 3CR. Your subscriptions are really important. They go beyond a donation and actually mean that you're a part of the 3CR community. You get a say in how the station functions, and it's a really great way to participate in the 3CR community and keep us going independent and on air for another year. So please subscribe to 3CR by heading to 3cr.org.au/subscribe, or you can call the station on 03-9419-8377. Again, that is 03-9419-8377. Thanks so much for listening. We love you all so much and really appreciate everything that you bring to the 3CR community.
Stand in solidarity with Palestine this Sunday.
With the most devastating attack ever launched on the people of Gaza, it's time for all of us to stand in solidarity with the Palestinian people.
Israel has waged war on the Palestinians for the last 75 years. The Nakba, ethnic cleansing, occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem and Gaza.
We have to mobilise to show our support for Palestine. 12 p.m. State Library this Sunday.
Rally to demand freedom and justice for Palestine.
Free Palestine Melbourne is a 3CR supporter.
Like so many community organisations, we need your continued financial support to keep 3CR on air and our community connected and strong.
Consider selecting Auto Renew for your subscription so your subscription keeps rolling on every year.
We love the security of knowing we have your support into the future.
Head to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377 and remember to select recurring for your annual subscription.
I'm speaking now with journalist with Ireland's Business, Nick McClellan. And Nick, you argue that Donald Trump has disdain for international law, and surely this is shown clearly by the presence of the Israeli Prime Minister, Benjamin Netanyahu, at the White House, the man accused at the International Criminal Court of 2 war crimes and 3 crimes against humanity.
Indeed, Trump's public statement about clearing out Gaza is, a real indication of the fundamental racism and disdain for international law and indeed multilateralism that underlines a lot of US policy. And that's been clear by the Biden administration's support for Israel since October 2023, the billions of dollars of funding that's gone in to war in Gaza and the West Bank. What's striking, however, is Trump's style, where he doesn't pretend that this is done to reinforce the international rules-based order. And I think what we're seeing is a fundamental challenge to international law, human rights law particularly, and multilateral institutions. And that's pretty striking because those institutions are widely used by Pacific Island countries. So, for example, Trump has announced that he's going to withdraw the United States from the World Health Organization and the United Nations Human Rights Council. Now, the WHO, through a unit based in Suva, Fiji, during the COVID pandemic, played a really crucial role in coordinating the supply of drugs, vaccines, COVID protection equipment and so on across 26 countries and territories in the Pacific during 2021-22. So the WHO, as a coordinating body, has played a pretty important role for small island states and in areas like malaria and other infectious diseases. It's pretty significant too. Similarly, Trump's announced that he'll pull out of the UN Human Rights Council, a real symbol of his contempt for human rights. And that's once again important. In recent years, Fiji and the Marshall Islands have both won seats on the Human Rights Council, particularly since Pacific Island countries joined with the Asia bloc in the UN system. So it's now called the Asia-Pacific Small Island Developing States bloc. That gives them a number of votes, and they've leveraged that to get action on issues around the oceans and nuclear issues to some and so on. So, for example, last year I worked with colleagues in the Marshall Islands and a team from the Office of the High Commission on Human Rights to prepare a report on the human rights legacies of nuclear testing, where the United States conducted 67 atomic and hydrogen bomb tests in the Marshall Islands back in the 1940s, 1950s. People still living with the consequences today. So the Marshalls has leveraged its role on the UN Human Rights Council to push the Americans about cleanup and compensation that is still required from nuclear testing more than 70 years ago. And what's striking is that Trump's pulling out of the Human Rights Council, and that's a symbol of this challenge. And, you know, small island states have always regarded UN structures as valuable, you know, in the General Assembly or the World Health Organization. The People's Republic of China and Tuvalu both get a vote. And so America moving towards this push for primacy really undercuts the way in which countries in the Pacific have used these structures for action on climate, on oceans, on development and other issues.
Well, looking at those two organisations, WHO and HRC, how important is it to have US there? Is it the funding? Is it the personnel? Can their place be taken by others?
Well, it will be taken by others, but the real problem is more that the US is actively campaigning against institutions that are designed to promote and implement human rights. And these are, you know, often frail, they're often hypocritical. There's no need to have illusions about the nature of the UN, given the veto power that's given to great and powerful nations. But you only have to look at the way in which the Biden administration attacked the International Criminal Court over its decision to issue charges against both Hamas leaders and the Prime Minister of Israel and senior ministers over Israel's war crimes and crimes against humanity in Gaza. One of the striking areas, of course, is climate. On the first day of office, Donald Trump purported to pull out of the Paris Agreement on climate change. And obviously, climate is the greatest security, development and human rights challenge facing our Pacific Island neighbours. This happened before. In June 2017, during his first term of office, Trump also pulled out of Paris Agreement, arguing that it undermined the US economy. Now, although China's the largest emitter of greenhouse gases in the world at the moment, historically, over time since the Industrial Revolution, the greatest cumulative production of greenhouse gases is the United States. And so Trump stepping out of this global framework treaty, which has already been captured by fossil fuel industries, is a significant change to this. One practical effect, of course, is that Trump is are going to halt contributions to international climate finance, including the Green Climate Fund. And many Pacific Island countries have relied on the Green Climate Fund, the Global Environment Facility, and other climate mechanisms to gain resources to address all the challenges that they face in the climate emergency. The US is a big donor in those areas, despite the fact that it's also one of the biggest oil producers in the world. This is bipartisan. Under Joe Biden, he escalated the shift away from reliance on Middle East oil to boost oil, gas, and shale oil production in the United States. The United States is now an exporter of oil rather than an importer because of this fundamental shift under both Democratic and Republican administrations. Trump just disdains to pretend that he's doing things for the environment by claiming, quote, drill baby drill, by opening up the Arctic for exploration, for oil and gas exploitation, and so on. There's a whole lot of theatre to some of this, though. I mean, in the executive order that Trump issued saying that they were going to withdraw from the Paris Agreement, he claimed that, and I quote, the United States will consider its withdrawal from the agreement and any attendant obligations to be effective immediately. Well, that's actually not what the treaty says. If you lodge a formal notice of intention to withdraw from the climate treaty, it only comes into effect after 12 months. And in the meantime, any country that wants to withdraw has to maintain its commitments already made under the Paris Agreement. So Trump is just pretending that he can just do what he wants. Once again, a clear breach of international law. But for the Pacific, this is pretty fundamental. One of the features about the Pacific is its sort of requirement for long-term sustainable relationships. Whether it's with China or the United States or Australia or anyone, there's a need for consistency in the relationship. Fiji's former ambassador to the United Nations wrote an article in our magazine, Islands Business, just the other day. And he said, and I quote, "The Pacific detests stop-start approaches to engagement and re-engagement. The Pacific values consistency." You know, the very fact that Biden pledged $3 billion for the Green Climate Fund, Trump's now ripping up that pledge, as he did when Obama pledged money for the Green Climate Fund, and he ripped it up during his first term of office. For small island countries that are trying to plan responses to the climate change, this sort of nonsense is causing enormous stress, and it opens the way for China to ramp up its capacity in 2022 in Shandong province in China. Beijing created a China Pacific Island Countries Climate Coordinating Center, offering training and financial support for climate action. You can bet that the Chinese are going to ramp up their support in that area as the US pulls its plug on climate action.
Seems counterproductive to me to the US to do that, because they know what's going to happen. They know that China's going to move into the space that they leave, surely.
Yes, and it's really interesting because there's this fundamental contradiction in all of this. You know, I found a report from the Heritage Foundation from October last year called The Pacific Pivot, an American Strategy for the Pacific Islands. So in the lead up to the November election last year, key conservative think tanks in the United States started mapping out a program and mobilizing their troops for a Trump administration. It was pretty clear that Kamala Harris was going to get beaten like a gong. So every right-wing nutjob in the United States started mapping out their wish list. But the Heritage Foundation is quite significant. It's based in Washington, D.C. It's the organization that coordinated what was called Project 2025, which is an 800-odd page master plan for what the Trump administration should do. And most of it's unachievable, but it's interesting. It's sort of, as I say, it's a wish list of what people would like to do. So this report, called The Pacific Pivot, A Strategy for the Pacific Islands, in fact shows the consistencies with what Biden was doing under the Democratic administration, but they're just much more upfront about their agenda. This Heritage Foundation report says, quote, "Competition with China is the single most important driver of U.S. re-engagement with the Pacific Islands. The U.S. must adopt a clear-eyed approach in putting American interests and objectives in the Pacific Islands first." That's what every country does. I mean, Australia does that. The so-called national interest test in Australia's aid program means that even humanitarian aid we provide overseas is calibrated according to so-called Australian national interest, not in the interest of all of us ordinary people, but in terms of the state's interest. So just Trump says up front, and his supporters say up front, what is actually happening. Joe Biden, as Democratic president, developed a Pacific partnership strategy in 2022 as he hosted Pacific Islander leaders at the White House. The Heritage Foundation welcomes, you know, the Pacific's important, we've got to keep the Chinese out. But they complain that Biden's strategy conveys objectives about engaging with the Pacific in a manner that ranks the interests of the Pacific Islands above American interests. A stronger strategy would prioritize the articulation of U.S. interests and how the strategy advances them. Yes, the Americans want to engage with the Pacific Islands, as Trump did during his first term of office, but they ditched the Biden idea that, you know, they should meet the needs of Pacific Island countries. This is about the articulation of U.S. interest and how the strategy advances them. This report just criticizes Biden's climate policy in the Pacific. It says the shortcoming of this government strategy is its overemphasis on combating the effects of climate change as a vital American interest. The Biden administration's emphasis on climate change mitigates other pressing U.S. interests demanding more immediate attention. So here you've got the Heritage Foundation, you know, 6 months ago, talking about basically climate is not the priority in the Pacific. Now, any Pacific government, community leader and church leader and so on you speak to will stress that climate is the greatest single threat around livelihoods, around security, around well-being, around the existential future of the region. But you only have to see what's happened in the last couple of weeks, and it has only been a couple of weeks. Billionaire entrepreneurs like Elon Musk and Vivek Ramaswamy until recently have been slashing funding around environment, around overseas aid, around development programs, the attack on USAID, the Environment Protection Authority, the National Oceanic and Aeronautic Administration, NOAA, has been a structure that's done an awful lot of work in the Pacific Islands around climate, reef ecology and things like that. I saw in the news this morning, there's a report that the NOAA budget is going to get a 50% cut and 30% of the staff are going to get sacked. Now, this is much as the United States continues to talk about engagement with the Pacific Islands, Trump and his cronies are busy smashing up the institutions that implement that. And that's quite contradictory with the aim of countering Chinese influence because, alongside Australia and Japan and others, the Chinese are obviously going to step into gaps that the US has pledged over the last couple of years.
Could I take you back to when Trump came in last time in 2016? Did he promise things and do all these same sort of things in the early days of his presidency and then calm down a bit?
Well, he never calmed down. You know, he announced in 2017 that he was going to pull out of the Paris Agreement. It actually took some time. And ironically, because of the legal requirements to formally withdraw from an international treaty, something that Trump pretends he doesn't have to deal with, it took 2 or 3 years to actually get out of the Paris Agreement when he did so in his first term of office. Ironically, it was in 2020 that the US formally ended their involvement in the Paris Agreement, and Joe Biden restarted on the first day of office when he came in, January 2021. So this is the game once again. It's interesting, as I say, that Trump's executive order says that our withdrawal takes place immediately. Well, under international law, it doesn't. But there's going to be obviously a tussle around this question. For people in the Pacific who are reliant on resources from overseas to assist them in the transition, this is going to reinforce the recognition that they have to act on their own. And, you know, one of the fundamental efforts of Pacific Island countries is they want to make the connection between the adverse effects of climate change, the damage to the oceans, and international law and human rights. As we've talked about on the program before, last year, with support from student community environment groups, the government of Vanuatu launched a campaign to get an advisory opinion from the International Court of Justice on the legal obligations of countries around climate change and human rights. The argument is that the adverse effects of climate change will breach human rights, the right to health, the right to clean environment, the right to self-determination and others. If the ICJ ruling comes in the next couple of years, it will set a legal framework on international law that countries have an obligation to address these adverse effects because they damage human rights. We'll see what the ICJ says in a year or two, but that's a battleground that Pacific Island states have taken up, because they see the annual conference of the parties have been captured by fossil fuel industries. We've seen that in recent COPs in United Arab Emirates, in Azerbaijan. Australia wants to host a COP under the Albanese government in 2026. Yeah, we're one of the greatest exporters of fossil fuels, oil, coal, gas in the world. There's a real battle going on about trying to create institutions, frameworks, international norms, as well as mobilising on the ground to halt the fossil fuel industry. It's clear with his drill, baby, drill attitudes that Trump is trying to build on what Biden and the Democratic administration did to promote and expand the use of fossil fuels. And that's a fundamental threat to Pacific Island countries.
Funding civil society programs, that seems to be going against, well, all the other programs that he's doing. Is there a catch in that one too?
Yeah, look, it's really contradictory, and you have to wonder how stupid it is or how Machiavellian it is. The assault on USAID, that's the, you know, main overseas aid agency with a multi-billion dollar budget from the United States. USAID has been going for many years. It runs programs both on humanitarian assistance, but it also runs a whole range of so-called good governance programs, which are basically about promoting US soft power. And dare I say, it's like what used to be AusAid, the Australian Agency for International Development, which has now been swallowed up by DFAT. These aid agencies have a double edge. On the one hand, they're about promoting Australian soft power, but on the other hand, the resources do significant humanitarian work in some of the poorest countries in the world. And we see that in our region, in Solomon Islands, in other places. The battle over how much the aid program is about boomerang aid, benefiting Australian or American interests rather than the interests of locals. But that's always been the battleground. Nonetheless, many countries in the Pacific are reliant on overseas assistance. Under the Biden administration, the US State Department, USAID and other institutions under the Democrats ran a series of programs to promote American soft power as part of their re-engagement with the Pacific Islands. You know, in 1992, the US pulled out of the Solomon Islands, shut down their embassies, closed off the Peace Corps program, and there was only 3 decades later when China signed a security agreement with the Solomon Islands government that the US started re-engaging in the Solomons. But these are pretty open. The US State Department, for example, under Biden, had a $2 million annual Indo-Pacific Media Advancement Program. That was a 2-year program called Countering PRC Influence Grants. The US would give grants to media organizations to counter People's Republic of China influence. The name says it all. And so there's an attempt to get journalists in the Pacific, and I declare my conflict of interest. A couple of the companies I've worked for over the years have received US, Australian, Chinese funding. These are attempts to try and mobilize civil society to criticize governments or corporations in the Pacific that don't follow the line, the anti-China line that's being promoted by Canberra and Washington and things like that. And this happened under the Democrats. Ed Case, who's a US congressman in Hawaii, is a Democrat and co-founder of the House of Representatives Pacific Islands Caucus. He put forward a bill just in November, just before Biden lost office, called the Engage the Pacific Act. And that bill would require the Secretary of State and the USAID and so on to establish a committee for engagement with civil society organizations in the Pacific Islands. So this is an attempt to use American soft power. And yet Trump is very busy destroying USAID as we speak, or Elon Musk certainly is having a go, calling it a hotbed of left-wing Marxists. Can I say my experience of engaging with USAID officers over the years in the Pacific? Not a lot of Marxists amongst them from my finding, but anyway, that's how it goes. Look, all of this, as I say, is fundamentally about the United States and its allies, including Australia, trying to stop Chinese influence in the Pacific and using the many tools in the toolbox to achieve that end. Trump is just a lot more overt about it, about that agenda, than other administrations, including the Albanese government. But he's putting it on the line about the primary driver of a lot of this action is the US-China strategic competition. And that's a big problem for the Pacific Islands Forum, for neighbouring countries. The geopolitics occurring in our region is not welcomed by any of us in the Pacific, says Forum Secretary General Baron Wonga last October. Pacific Island countries repeatedly keep saying, we don't want to choose sides in the strategic competition between China and the United States. Now, the Albanese government is working to force people to do so, particularly in the security area. We've seen since 2023, the Albanese government signing agreements, the Falapilli Union with Tuvalu, a Nauru-Australia treaty, a deal over the National Rugby League with Papua New Guinea, all three of which have got some positive elements around climate funding and so on, and sports activity with Papua New Guinea. But all three require that the Pacific government not engage with China on security issues. To stop, for example, policing agreements with China as opposed to the Australian Federal Police. So the Albanese government, much more quietly than Donald Trump, has been engaged in trying to maintain strategic denial across the Pacific Islands to keep out Chinese influence. The very fact Albanese, unlike Germany, Canada, Britain and others, won't condemn Trump's stupidity over ethnic cleansing in Gaza is a sign of how trapped Albanese is with the AUKUS agreement, fearful that the Trump administration will ramp up the cost of buying submarines and screw the Australian security state's attempts to get nuclear submarines. They're not even willing to criticise ethnic cleansing and dispossession of the Palestinian people in a way that Britain, Germany and other senior leaders have done in the last few days. It's a sign of the looming election in Australia and the capture of policy by AUKUS that we're in a situation where the government is reluctant to deal with the reality of what's happening in the United States. And that's going to cause significant problems because our Pacific Island neighbours are going to be looking to China, to Korea, to Japan, to Middle East countries to pick up the slack of funding that's being slashed by Washington as we speak.
I'd imagine there's no talk of cutting funding to the many US bases in the Pacific nations.
I suspect not. They haven't talked about it very much. Donald Trump is, in fact, talking about a meeting with Xi Jinping, trying to get in the next month or so an engagement. You know, this image of Trump as deal maker, he thinks he can solve the conundrum. What we've seen in recent years under both Trump and Biden in recent presidencies has been the militarization of the Northern Pacific. And Australia is drawn into that through AUKUS and ANZUS. The US has major military bases in Hawaii, Guam, US missile testing range at Kwajalein Atoll in the Marshall Islands. You know, because now Guam, is, which is, you know, in the Western Pacific, closer to the Philippines than most parts of the US, is within range of both Chinese and North Korean ballistic missiles. The Biden administration has been talking about developing a stealing more land on Guam to build 20 sites to put anti-ballistic missile systems on Guam. The US has also been talking about creating the capacity to disperse its forces from the major naval base in Apra Harbor and the Anderson Air Force Base. They've been building, I should say rebuilding, World War II airstrips in neighboring Micronesian countries like Palau, the Commonwealth of the Northern Marianas, and so on. With the idea that U.S. aircraft based in Guam, if they look like they were going to get attacked by China, could disperse to other countries in the region. So, of course, in the Northern Pacific, that's going to draw more and more very peaceful countries that don't have any military forces, are not a target for anything, except that the U.S. is going to base their troops there. That's, of course, what's happening in Australia. We've long been integrated into U.S. nuclear warfighting strategies through the presence of Pine Gap, through engagement, but that's been ramping up in recent years. And so under AUKUS, we see plans for US and UK nuclear submarines to be based in West Australia and operate under the control of US or UK command systems to prepare for Chinese activity in the region. We now have the rotation not only of US Marines, but also of B-52H bombers through Tyndall Air Base and through other bases near Katherine in the Northern Territory. Striking that B-52H bombers, half of them in the US fleet, are capable of being armed with nuclear weapons. The obvious question is, are the B-52H bombers coming through Northern Australia armed with nuclear weapons? Of course, the US will neither confirm nor deny. Does the Australian government have a policy to ban nuclear weapons from its soil? These sort of contradictions are pretty evident. And so we see, as Marines are relocated from Okinawa to Guam to Northern Australia, that there's a growing integration, so-called what Richard Miles calls interoperability, wonderful piece of jargon, which means that we are aligning the Australian Defence Force with US warfighting strategies, particularly nuclear warfighting strategies, just as Pacific Island countries for a long time have been saying they, you know, with memories of World War II, they don't want to get entangled in World War III. This is a significant change. 11 members, more than half the membership of the Pacific Islands Forum, including New Zealand, have signed and ratified the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. This is not an arms control treaty. This is a treaty calling for the abolition of nuclear weapons. That's also been signed by two-thirds of ASEAN, including Indonesia, the largest nation within in population within ASEAN. And that's fundamental because in the 1960s, successive governments in Australia, particularly Liberal ones, thought about developing nuclear weapons in Australia. And one of the reasons for that was the so-called threat from the North, the fear that Indonesia in the mid-60s, until the massacre of communists and workers and trade unionists by the Suharto regime, there was a fear that Indonesia might go nuclear. Here today you have the Indonesian state, despite its human rights violations in Aceh and West Papua and other places, the Indonesian state has said, we don't want to go nuclear in the current context. They've signed and ratified in last year the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. That undercuts the whole line that's come from many people in the think tanks and so on, nuclear strategists and armed control arms enthusiasts, that Indonesia might go nuclear in the future. The Indonesians are saying, well, that's a path, but we're not going to take it. And so with two-thirds of ASEAN, more than half the Pacific Islands Forum, our ASEAN partner New Zealand, all saying, we want a pathway to the abolition of nuclear weapons, it leaves both the Australian Labor Party and the ONP looking very isolated. Albanese, in ALP national policy, pledged to sign to TPNW. Can I say, I don't think that's going to happen before the elections. And so we're left like a shag on the rock as countries around the region are choosing sides, not with China, not with the United States, but with measures to try and deal with the world as it's changing in an era of nuclear saber-rattling.
Could I just take you back, Nick, to what you said about troops and equipment moving out of Okinawa into Guam? Does that mean that that base is closing or just downgrading?
Downgrading. And that's the result of people's struggles in Okinawa for, well, since the 1950s, 60s. You know, after the occupation of Japan by US, Australian and Allied forces after the Second World War, Okinawa and the Ryukyu Islands became a major hub for US military facilities. Kadena Air Base in Okinawa, for example, is an enormous air base. For decades and decades, ordinary Okinawans have resisted the presence of US air and marine forces in Okinawa. Helicopter accidents, shocking examples of sexual assault and rape by US Marines against Okinawan women and children. Over many years, the People's Mobilization in Okinawa has tried to get the US to pull out forces. And that pressure worked over time. And the US government, several administrations ago, announced plans to bring 8,000 Marines that are based in Okinawa to Guam. That process has slowed, and there's been resistance in Guam as well, because land is very short supply. To build housing for 8,000 Marines plus family members and so on is going to be an enormous battleground, and that continues to this day. The US established a new base called Camp Blaz in Guam, which is a US Marine base, and up to 5,000 Marines are being relocated. The other three from the original mob are being rotated through northern Australia, courtesy of Julia Gillard and successive governments. They said they rotate, but effectively they're there all year. They just bring in different units after a period in Australia, but pretty much full-time there are US Marines operating in the Northern Territory and engaged in war games and military exercises alongside the Australian Defence Force and alongside other forces from neighbouring countries. So we're very much integrated into this process. And I think that's a real tension in policy that Donald Trump will bring to the fore. To a certain extent, while people have been critical of AUKUS, they've accepted the Albanese's commitment, around AUKUS. But now, as Trump talks about regional conflicts, about ethnic cleansing in Gaza, about, other human rights violations, is Australia going to go all the way into the dump with Donald Trump as we went all the way with LBJ? I think, this presents contradictions to whoever wins the elections in April this year.
Good day, Nick. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jan, as always. I look forward to speaking again.
And Nick McClellan is a journalist with Islands Business Online.
3CR is one of a kind. We have 400 volunteers and cover an incredible array of programming content.
From special broadcast events on Invasion Day or Trans Day of Visibility to any of our 120 weekly shows, 3CR has got your radical radio listening covered.
Subscribe to 3CR at 3cr.org.au and support independent, community-owned media, free of commercial influence and government bias.
Help to keep 3CR unique by becoming a subscriber today.
Part of this year's National Sustainability Festival, featuring a huge lineup of sustainability innovators and events throughout February. On Sunday the 16th, join Gardening Australia's Costa Georgiadis for a festival family picnic adventure. Bring a picnic rug along with your homegrown harvest to the Royal Botanic Gardens in Melbourne for an afternoon of children's music, creativity and sustainability. Explore the festival's full program online at sustainabilityfestival.au. The National Sustainable Living Festival is a 3CR supporter.
Show your solidarity. Subscribe. Go to 3cr.org.au or call 9419 8377.
And part two of the monthly segment with Bob Phelps, the Executive Director of the Gene Ethics Network, an organisation with the initials IUCN. Who are they and what do they do?
Well, that's the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. They're an international organisation based in Switzerland, which is trying to implement particularly the findings of the Convention on Biological Diversity. Their concerns are about nature, about the maintenance of ecosystems in the world, which under climate change and other insults, mostly delivered by human beings, like land clearing, pollution with plastics and all sorts of other things. The IUCN is a coalition of interested non-government organisations that have to pay a fee for membership, and government departments. So several government, Australian government departments are members of IUCN, as are, I think, about a dozen Australian organisations, environmental organisations like the Conservation Foundation, Marine Conservation in Queensland, and others, who have as their primary concern the maintenance of our life support systems on this earth, because unless somebody looks out for them, degradation is going to continue and we can envisage the collapse of things that we depend on to survive. And of course, the big red flags are that other species are going extinct. And we shouldn't imagine that this is sort of like incidental. The fact that ecosystems are disrupted by many of their animal, insect, plant, and other inhabitants go extinct and disrupt the ecosystems, the environments on which life on this planet relies. These are not small-time things to be concerned about. And the Convention on Biological Diversity is a significant and important international peace treaty, a treaty that holds big conferences, as we've just recently seen again with the Convention of the Parties, COP. Also, it relates to the MOP, which is the Convention for the Cartagena Protocol, which is the protocol for biosafety, where genetically engineered organisms are transferred internationally. And this convention, which is part of the Convention on Biological Diversity, tries to ensure that any transfer of genetically engineered organisms will be done safely and not adversely impact on the environment. So the IUCN is a global organisation. It's got government and NGO members. At the moment, it's developing a policy on synthetic biology, and this process has been going on for several years. And the draft policy that's popped out at the other end, unfortunately, is pretty negative from our point of view. It's quite disposed to allowing nature to be genetically engineered to deal with so-called pests. These are the things that annoy human beings or have incidental impacts, like rodents on offshore islands, for example, that eat birds' eggs and knock down the populations of important species. Yeah, not incidental, but we shouldn't think that rodents, if we eradicated them on a regional or global basis, wouldn't have huge impacts as well on the stability of our environments. In ecosystems, everything's connected, and you knock out one thing, you end up with a mess. The discussion at the IUCN at the moment and in the lead up to its Congress in October is that the wild needs to be respected, and we shouldn't be letting go genetic engineering entities like gene drives, for example, which are seen by some people as the future of pest management. worldwide. We've already intervened, in our view, much too much in the management of environments. You know, they can manage themselves provided we leave them alone and don't chop down all the trees, which is going on globally, and we don't pollute the oceans with plastic and other pollutants.
When is a decision on this policy likely?
Well, there might be a decision in October at the Congress, but I suspect that it might go on longer than that. At the moment, we're trying to recruit non-government organisations globally. We've got a small working group on it to support the alternative policy, which would take a much more precautionary approach than the one that's official at the moment. It already has been a long discussion covering several years, but I think that it might still need some more discussion before we finally come up with a solution about how nature is going to be managed, because it seems that everybody wants to be in management. But we've just seen, for instance, the management of the Murray-Darling cost $13 billion and is an abject failure. Everywhere humans try to intervene and do major processes of regulating the environment and intruding to maintain the environment, we see disasters. You know, the Earth in many ways needs to be left alone to do its own thing and to look after its own health and well-being. If human beings weren't exploiting its resources so intensely for profits, really. Of course, we're dependent on our environments and we do need some resources, but really we're totally interdependent with our environments. If we extinguish all the species and we keep interfering, we're going to be in terminal strife as a species. Human extinction's not impossible.
Let's turn to another university, this time the University of Queensland, and they're asking for sorghum field trials. Why?
They're trying to adjust sorghum, which is a potential new major crop for Australian farmers, so that it asexually reproduces rather than having to share DNA between plants. They want it to be able to control the production of seed. And I'm not quite sure what their overarching objective is, but again, it's a matter of getting control. It is out for discussion. We submitted a comment on it by last Friday. The main thing here is about weediness. There are now scads of plants out in our environments that disrupt agriculture and also interfere with the functioning of natural environments. And the relatives of sorghum, one of those, there's a particular weed called Johnson grass, which is declared a weed nationally. And yet these field trials, although they're contained at the moment, would have the buffer zones around them. Our view is that the buffer zones are not sufficient. In previous trials, they've found that the Johnson grass did intrude. Yeah, it was possible to hand treat it because we're talking 50 or 100 Johnson grass plants. But if it was out in the environment commercially over tens or thousands of hectares, there'd be no way of controlling the transfer of whatever new characteristics you give to sorghum over to Johnson grass and a range of other related troublesome weeds that farmers, of course, are now spraying toxic tank mixes on to get them under control or to keep them under control. And again, it's a major messing with our environment. When couldn't we just leave alone the sorghum that we're now producing and having much less intrusive impacts on other parts of our environment? Again, it appears to be commercially motivated. We've argued to the regulator, the Office of Gene Technology Regulator, that we should just leave well enough alone, and that this issue of weediness is a key one that should discredit this particular experiment, get the regulator to say no. To their credit, last year they were asked to approve a ryegrass trial, which was promoted by a company from New Zealand, which had already field trialed it there and in North America. The trials had failed, and then they brought them to Australia. Now, ryegrass is already a huge weed in natural and agricultural systems in Australia. And we just again pointed out to them, here you've got an invitation to spreading herbicide resistance and various other unmanageable characteristics to what is now already known as a weed nationally. Why can't we just say no? And indeed, the company was encouraged to withdraw its application, which it did. I think the OGTR is not too keen on rejecting anything that's put before it. So it gets the company to withdraw the application, which is what they did on this particular occasion as well.
Well, from sorghum to canola, GM canola, what's the story there?
GM canola, which tolerates being sprayed with Roundup herbicide at higher doses and more often, was approved and is now grown, particularly in northern Australia, where the climate is more suited to it, although it is grown also in parts of Victoria and New South Wales. The interesting thing there is that the strong global market for canola is for not genetically engineered, for canola that doesn't have the tolerance genes in it, particularly for Roundup. Those are the particular varieties that have been approved. Of course, as a result, because the global market, the global demand, particularly from Europe, is for canola that hasn't been genetically engineered, there is a premium. And at the moment, on a national basis, in South Australia, for instance, the premium for non-GM canola versus GM varieties is $100 a tonne. And we're talking about $100 out of a sale price of something like $650. So a pretty substantial percentage of the value. In Victoria, $60 per tonne discount for GM in Melbourne. And in New South Wales, been steady for a long time at just $15. But some farmers continue to grow it. They claim that by being able to spray Roundup liberally over their canola crop, they can clean up their fields, have a better crop in the following season. Who knows what the economics are really, but something like 30% of the canola grown in WA at the moment is genetically engineered for herbicide tolerance. In the other states, maybe 10 or 15%. It's hard to tell exactly what it is, but it's driven by this, we'll clean up our fields, we'll get those darn weeds under control, and we'll do better next year. And the problem with that, again, is that by repeated spraying of the same chemical, which is now a no-no in many parts of the world as a result of its propensity to cause non-Hodgkin's lymphoma in the people who are exposed to it, there are now over 100,000 payouts that Bayer has made in the USA for people who are suffering from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma as a result of their exposure to Roundup, and another something of the order of 50,000 are going through the US courts. There's all that, but the weeds, because they're repeatedly sprayed, adapt to the fact that they're sprayed with a particular chemical which is going to kill them. Of course, there are survivors, and those survivors propagate. They are the ones that can resist being sprayed with Roundup. And very soon, you've got a whole raft of different weeds that can't be controlled by the most used herbicide. And so farmers are falling back on tank mixes of a variety of different herbicides. They do double knock, so they spray again after they've done it once in order to try to kill the remaining weeds. It just becomes a treadmill of toxicity, not only out in the environment, but also in the crop and in the food supply. Of course, shoppers, so the public at large, from all the chemicals, and there are hundreds of them that are sprayed on various crops, whether from fruit and veggies to grains, etc., these all add up to a public health hazard as well, despite the fact that our regulators say they're within acceptable limits. It's just a mess, and the red flag on this is the demand, the strongest demand, is for non-GM canola in most of the world. We should be supplying that and not spraying Roundup on canola crops, or indeed on cotton as well, which also comes into the food supply as vegetable oil and food thickener.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast. If you found it valuable, please consider donating or subscribing to support independent community radio. To find out more, go to 3cr.org.au.